From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an update of news and events from Latin America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua. Well, we have a lot of ground to cover, and we have to make sure that we look at closely the Argentinian election, but take it where you'd like. Start wherever you'd like.
Okay, well, and I think the elections of last weekend, obviously we have to talk about Argentina. But very important elections too in Colombia, in some ways more interesting than those in Argentina from our point of view.
Right. Well, we predicted Argentina 4 years ago, like right after the last one, basically.
Right. But the result in Argentina wasn't difficult to call, given everything that has happened over the last 4 years, and very easy to predict. But before we start talking about the elections, I'd just like to make a general point that might help people listening understand better the processes that have been in play over the weekend in these elections, but also more generally the processes that have been in play over the last 20 years. And I think it's really important for people to, and okay, so people will, commentators will talk about pink tides, and they'll talk about conservative restorations, but these kind of slogans have zero explanatory power to explain what is actually happening. And what is happening, in my opinion, is that I remember having this argument many years ago back in the 1980s with people supporting the Sandinista revolution. Back then, they were Marxists. They supported the whole idea of communism and communist revolution, etc., etc. But the fundamental thing that was happening back then was essentially a continuation of processes that began way back. And Daniel Ortega here in Nicaragua is very insistent on this. What you're talking about is centuries-old processes of resistance that are constant against external, the impositions and the of external powers from the Spanish conquest onwards, or more correctly, the European conquest onwards. And that's what we're seeing here, as what you have is a constant process of popular resistance that never stops. And in response to that process, you have a constant process of imperialist oppression in league with local elites.
Yep.
All the time.
Yep. I mean, and listen, just to, you know, on its face, you can see this just in the names of the movements. You have the Sandinista movement after Augusto Sandino in Nicaragua, for example, is from the early 20th century. Also, a Bolivar, who's even older in Venezuela and elsewhere in Latin America. These are, you know, the first stirrings of nationalism here that were suppressed by the United States for, in some cases, 200 years.
Yeah, the essential point from my point of view is that these phrases like pink tide and restoration give the idea that there's some neutral thing going on, that there's some actual pendulum process, and that's completely false.
Right.
And what you have are strong impulses of resistance, strong impulses of repression. That's what we're dealing with, and that's what these elections last weekend were all about.
Yeah.
Because in Argentina, you had fear of complete neoliberal repression of ordinary people and a savage attack on ordinary working people, people that in Argentina are relatively impoverished majority compared to other parts of Latin America, like Brazil and Colombia, for example, but still, you know, an impoverished majority that were under attack from their own government. And so It wasn't difficult to predict back in 2015 that there'd be a strong reaction against that, and that a relatively progressive forces like the Peronist forces, the Peronist Front, the Front for Everyone, the Frente de Todos, were going to win this election. That wasn't difficult to predict.
Right.
So, and when you look at that, but when you look at that result, and the actual result was as from the preliminary election count was something like 8%, which when you look, you'd expect it to be more, especially on the basis of the preliminary elections that were held earlier this year, and on election polls, which gave the Frente de Todos, led by Alberto Fernández, as the presidential candidate, with Cristina Fernández de Kirchner as the vice presidential candidate. They're not related. An advantage of almost 20%. And so you'd expected a much bigger margin in this election, but you didn't get it. And one thing to bear in mind is, when you look at that, not all the legislative seats were in play. Only about half the legislative seats, the right. seats in the National Assembly, were in play. And so what that means is that whereas Alberto Fernández and his team have a working majority in the Senate, I don't think they do in the Congress. We'll know in more detail once the final results are announced. And when the final results are announced, it's likely that the Fernández and his team will have a bigger lead. They're likely to have between 9% and 10%, because there's still something like, the last time I looked, there was still something like 800,000 votes to count in an area where the Fernandez team had a big majority over Macri. That's the province of Buenos Aires. But overall, it was a tremendously successful result for the progressive forces. Despite that rider that they're likely not to have an outright majority in the lower house of the assembly, which is going to complicate their obviously their legislative program.
Right.
But the other thing about that is that there's some uncertainty because it was a coalition, and I mentioned in previous conversations the role of Sergio Massa is likely to be important, because in the 2015 election he played as a spoiler and prevented Cristina Fernández, the candidate of Cristina Fernández' party, from winning. Last time, Macri only won with something like 2.4% of the vote. But this time, although he's lost by, it'll eventually turn out to be around 10%, I suspect. Although he's lost by that, and that is largely because people like Sergio Massa decided to throw in their lot with Alberto Fernández as a presidential candidate. And you can discuss that. There are lots of wrinkles to that we could talk about. But the main thing is that it's not at all clear what's likely to happen in terms of the implementation of the progressive policies, the progressive legislative program that Alberto Fernández is likely to try and get through the legislature. Now, we'll just have to see how that pans out. It's still not clear. One thing that is clear is that Alberto Fernández seems to be taking quite a proactive, not to say aggressive, approach to the foreign policy that Argentina is likely to follow. Because he's already having meetings with the authorities in Mexico, right. About, obviously, talking about how to reactivate UNASUR, how to reactivate CELAC as a more proactive body in terms of promoting regional integration. And that's going to be tremendously important.
Yep.
Some people are speculating about, and I think this is extremely foolish, and will Cristina Fernández be trying to pull the strings from behind the throne, behind the presidency? And I don't think that's on the cards at all. And I think that what's likely to happen, there's likely to be a division of labor, because Cristina is absolutely outstanding in terms of foreign policy. And
She served two terms herself, and her husband served a term as president. I mean, she knows the ropes, too.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the most logical thing, and I suspect this is what we'll see, but we don't know, because there's been no formal announcement along those lines, will be that although she's the vice president, Cristina Fernández is likely to be signed a very strong role on the international scene in terms of developing Argentina's foreign relations. Now, I think in a discussion that I saw that you had with Ian Williams, a commentator on foreign affairs on Press TV.
Yeah.
And there was also some discussion about what is likely to be domestic policy. And I think that I'm quite optimistic about the fact that, and I think you were right when you made your comment in that discussion, that Argentina needs to take an aggressive policy in terms of its foreign debt. And I think Cristina Fernández And to some extent, Alberto Fernández, although he dropped out just before Cristina's first presidency, and I think he dropped out of politics to do academic work because of policy disagreements. But Alberto Fernández and Cristina Fernández were both people key to the architecture of renegotiating Argentina's incredible levels of foreign debt back in the early 2000s, very successfully. And it was only because Mauricio Macri won the presidency in 2015 that the foreign funds were able to get their pound of flesh, almost literally.
In addition to that, on the one hand, what he did was he basically surrendered the negotiations that had been taking place and started writing checks and or defaulting or stipulating in court to whatever the other side wanted. And in addition to that, ran the economy so they were generating new debt that they could default on again, which is where we're at with I don't know, $150 billion or something now.
I know. It's more than it was back in 2000.
Yeah, it's worse. Yeah.
And the other unforgivable thing that Macri did was that he did it in such a way as to justify going cap in hand to the IMF so that the IMF could impose the austerity policies. And I think what happened in Argentina, the Argentinian people have been lucky to be able to extract themselves from the dead hand, the chokehold of the IMF and Macri's disgraceful neoliberal policies attacking the majority of people in Argentina.
So my point was basically what we had said a number of times about the conditions that existed at the last election, when you had so many people on the left, just enough, obviously, that sat on their hands because they didn't think that the government was being aggressive enough in that area, then, you know, and just repudiate the debt, turn your back on that, you know, let's build a socialist economy. There were some people on the left that wanted that from Cristina and didn't think they were getting enough of it, and so they sat on their hands and Macri got elected. This time, they voted, and I think that that means when the government now sits down at the table, they have a political constituency to play hardball.
Oh yeah, absolutely, and I think you're definitely right to note that the far left vote that was so unhelpful in the runoff last time in 2015, and they turned out on the first round and voted for the Fernandez team this time.
That's right.
And I think their share of the vote dropped from something around 5% and 6% down to something like 2%. But anyway, and that's we'll just have to see what happens in Argentina. What I was going to say was that the Argentinian people had the option of escaping the neoliberal austerity policy trap through electoral means, whereas people in Chile and people in Ecuador have not had that.
They
have
Brazil.
Not had that option. So
or Brazil. They haven't had it in Brazil either. I mean, it was stolen from them in Brazil.
But in the case of, sticking for a moment with Ecuador and Chile, you can see the results of that. And I think there's still ongoing protests in Chile. I think there's a general strike in Chile.
Yep, that's right.
The negotiations in Ecuador seem to have broken down because the indigenous people's side are presenting a proposal to Lenin Moreno's government. But on the streets, people in Ecuador and Chile have been forced onto the streets in order to protest against austerity and the neoliberal program imposed by local elites under U.S. patronage. So I'd like to shift for a moment, if that's okay, Don, and talk about Colombia.
Go for it. Yeah.
So in Colombia, there were not presidential elections, but there were very, very important regional and municipal elections, and that resulted in what is, in many ways, a devastating setback, if not a defeat, for the politics of Álvaro Uribe, former narco-terrorist president of Colombia, and his proxy, Iván Duque, who's the current president.
Yep.
Their parties suffered significant setbacks. Not only did the party of Álvaro Uribe not win the main municipal authorities in the capital, Bogota, which is regarded, being the mayor of Bogota is regarded as being the second most important political post after the president in Colombia. Right. But they also failed to win in Medellin, which is Álvaro Uribe's home turf.
Base, right.
And they also failed to win in Cali, which is another very, very important provincial capital outside the capital of Bogota. Now, Uribe's team will say, well, it's false to say that we've suffered a defeat because we actually increased the number of municipalities. But they're winning municipalities out in the boonies. And they got a total of, I think, around 150 in a country with 1,000, something like 1,100 and something municipalities. So, and it's not just that they didn't win. Where they lost badly. They came something like third or fourth or fifth behind other political groupings. And so in Colombia, a very important symbolic victory was that of Claudia Lopez in Bogota, the Green Party candidate, a lesbian candidate, a woman candidate. You know, and that's tremendously symbolic in terms of Colombia's very traditional,
very conservative social. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so then the other thing that's important is that a former FARC guerrilla, Julian Conrado, is his nom de guerre. I think his name's Guillermo. I've forgotten his surname. But he won a very important municipality in the province of Bolivar on the country's Caribbean coast. I think the municipality is called Tubarco. But although he wasn't running as a candidate for the FARC political party, he was running as a candidate for a coalition of progressive parties.
Right.
He won, and that's tremendously important boost for the peace process. The fact that an ex-guerrilla has now been elected, and so to a quite an important provincial municipal capital. And that's very important.
Yeah.
But the more important thing is that, and although municipal elections, and it's possible to argue that municipal elections are fought on local concerns and don't have that much national significance, a lot of people are saying that it was, in fact, a plebiscite, in effect. These regional municipal elections were, in fact, a plebiscite on the government of Iván Duque, and they lost badly. So that and relatively progressive candidates, not progressive in the sense of the Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela or the Sandinista Revolution in Nicaragua, or the MAS party, the movement towards socialism in Bolivia, perhaps not progressive in that sense, but progressive in the Colombian context. And they won. And what that means is that what we were talking about right at the beginning of the program, this impulse of resistance by the great majority in Latin America and the Caribbean for a decent life. And that is strongly embodied in these recent elections in Colombia. And they very much confirm a regional tendency that is obviously apparent in the elections in Argentina and strongly apparent, obviously, in the street protests in Chile and Ecuador. And so in regional terms, the elections in Colombia are in many ways as important as the elections that were held in Argentina over the weekend that resulted in this great victory for Alberto Fernández and his team. Less optimistic was the result in, or less positive from our point of view, was the result in Uruguay, where they also had the first round of a presidential election, and that panned out pretty much as we thought, pretty much as most people thought, with a win for the Frente Amplio candidate Daniel Martinez, but not by enough to win on first round, and so it goes to a second round, and it's not clear whether the what looks like a solid majority for the right wing based on the first round results will in fact result in a right wing victory. People I know from Uruguay, for example, my colleague Jorge Capelan, who's from Uruguay, although he's now a naturalized Nicaraguan citizen, he says that the way the second round is likely to pan out is likely to give a narrow win to the Frente Amplio. Well, we'll see. But and that's on, when's that? November the 24th, I think, is the runoff in Uruguay.
Yeah.
Something interesting in the region, Don, that perhaps hasn't been noted is that Bolsonaro in Brazil is very angry with the O Globo TV network because they've, which is an extremely right-wing organization and was a key in media terms in promoting Bolsonaro's victory in the last presidential elections. O Globo TV is trying to link Bolsonaro to the murder of Marielle Franco, a very prominent left-wing activist, very prominent in the gender scene in Brazil, which is very important in Brazil. And I think that's very significant because I think it means that, and that is yet another sign that the Bolivian elites are getting fed up with Bolsonaro and extremely nervous about what is happening in the regional context with the victory for the Fernandez team in Argentina, the extreme protests out on the streets in Chile and Ecuador. They're getting nervous about, and also very much, the setback for the right wing in Colombia in the recent regional municipal elections. The elites in Brazil are getting very nervous.
Yeah.
And rightly so. And I think this spat between the O Globo TV monopoly and President Bolsonaro is quite significant. It's a sign that Bolsonaro no longer has the kind of support that he was able to mobilize during his election. So I think I commented in the past that it's perfectly possible that Bolsonaro won't reach the end of his presidential term because the right-wing elites will maneuver in order to get a more acceptable candidate for the next round of presidential elections in Brazil. And Bolsonaro, in the same way that Macri got hammered in Argentina's electoral context,
right.
Bolsonaro is likely to get hammered if he tries to go for re-election in the Brazilian electoral context. And that's without the likely release at some point over the next year or so of Lula da Silva. Currently, the Supreme Court is considering a legal case that involved looking at the impact of a previous judgment by a lower court that in theory should lead immediately to Lula's release, because the lower court ruled that the kind of in the cases of people that had not exhausted all their legal possibilities for their defense, they should not be imprisoned until all those remedies have been exhausted.
Right.
And that very much applies in the case of former President Lula da Silva. So that judgment should be any day now. It might even happen this week. Let's see.
Well, but that you know, you got also this. I mean, you can amplify this almost by two orders of magnitude. First, the entire structure in Brazil stands on an illegitimate coup. I mean, you have a divided electorate like you have everywhere else there. You have an illegal coup, the appointment of a president who governs essentially with 2% favorability. Remember that? 2% to mayor. And then an election where the most popular candidate polling, he's in jail while he's polling, and he's still the most popular presidential candidate. And so he's not allowed to be on the ballot. People's votes aren't going to count for him. They make this clear. And so this guy who's backed by the entire right, center, and external money and all the media squeaks in. I mean, you know, compared to what it would have been with, he would have lost to Lula.
Right.
So
oh, yeah.
he comes in and then they start eating him. So, I mean, all of the people that are attacking him now as allies, their entire team rested on, you know, at the edge, basically, because they had zero legitimacy with half the population, and a good part of the other half understood that was a coup that put them in the first place. And so, you know, they're watching developments there, like, oh, we got to make sure that there's not a misstep because the hordes are right behind, you know, right behind each action. And now, you know, I mean, these are no lightweight allegations made against him and his son, involvement with death squads.
Right.
You know?
No, I think that's right. And time will tell. And right. This judgment that's due in the case of former President Lula da Silva is going to be very important. And if as they should, they rule in Lula's favor, he's immediately out of jail. And he remains, of course, the head of the Workers' Party in Brazil.
Right.
And who knows what's going to happen? And the Brazilian elites must be terrified at the prospect of Lula getting out of jail. And that's why the judges are under pressure not to let him go, even though it's obvious that he should be set free. But anyway, we'll see. Yeah. We'll see. So then, and looking at elsewhere, and it's easy to forget about countries like Paraguay, Haiti, Honduras. But in Paraguay, for example, they're very widespread. I don't know if they're at a national level yet, but very widespread rural workers' protests against the corrupt government of Abdo Benitez, that itself is under some kind of judicial process as a result of trying to negotiate a secret deal with the Brazilian authorities over the hydroelectric resources of the Itaipu Dam, which is a very important source of revenue for the Paraguayan government. It's easy to forget about Paraguay, but in fact, the events there very much reflect similar events elsewhere, similar popular uprising, popular protest. In Paraguay's case, they're not tied to an immediate increase in the cost of living. But it's not difficult to see that the events in Paraguay could follow a similar course,
right,
if a trigger like a dramatic increase in the cost of living is imposed on the majority there in Paraguay. And that's what's happened in Haiti. That's what's happened in Chile. And that's what happened in Ecuador. And there were dramatic increases in costs that were absolutely basic to the majority of people in those countries. In Haiti, it's hard to see how the current president can survive the current crisis, except that he has the absolutely unconditional backing of the foreign powers that have occupied Haiti. And via their NGOs, directly via the UN in the past, and continue to occupy it in neo-colonial terms, in terms of controlling investment, controlling their access to loans in the multilateral organization. So the US, Canada, and France principally are the ones that are responsible for propping up President Moises in power in Haiti. I don't see how he could possibly have survived this long,
right,
if they weren't. So, and let's see what happens there. In Honduras, narco-president Juan Orlando Hernandez is facing a new coalition, a new political coalition that is trying to articulate itself effectively with the popular protests that are taking place in Honduras against the U.S.-backed
post-coup government. And we got to stop here because we're out of time. But just a very quick note on the way out that both in Honduras and Paraguay, in one fashion or another, the current governments rest on U.S.-backed coups, soft or hard. And that's going to play out. We'll catch up with you next week and see if we can't finish this stuff and then update people on what happens between now and then. Thanks a lot.
We look forward to it, Don. Thanks a million.
Thanks, Tony. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.